Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. Our next guest is Dan Wallach. He is Assistant Professor in the Systems Group at Rice University's Department of Computer Science. 9 years in computer security, has a PhD from Princeton. If you search him on the internet, you'll find hundreds at least of papers written by him on topics of computer security and different things in that area. And is the co-author of an analysis of an electronic voting system from Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute, and another study called authentication. Pardon me, authentication for remote voting, published by the Workshop on Human Computer Interaction and Security Systems in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's very good to have you on. My pleasure. I hope you can teach us a little bit about these new computerized voting systems. There's a pretty important election coming up in, just about 10 days. And I know that last time I voted at the local precinct in my neighborhood, I had no choice. There was no paper ballot alternative or anything, and I had to hit the button on a computer and trust that my vote was counted. And I'm sure I'm going to have to do the same thing here in 10 days. And I wonder, is there any reason I should trust that the computer is counting my vote?
Well, that's a good question. What you're really asking is, why should I trust it? Why, they're telling us that these voting systems are trustworthy. Why should we believe them? And the burden of proof is on the companies that sold this gear. You know, likewise here in Houston and Harris County, they replaced all of our old punch card systems with this shiny new computerized thing. And I've been in debates where on one side you had me and the other side you had the vice president of marketing from this firm, Hart InterCivic. And I would challenge him, say, you know, what reason do we have to believe that this works? And the vendors will talk about their logic and accuracy tests. And they'll talk about how they have an ISO 9000 certified process. And they'll talk about various things. But there's no reason why any of that should be considered to be proof that their stuff works. Consider
why not? That sounds reasonable, I think. Accuracy tests and so forth.
Well, so first off, ISO 9000 talks about business process. It doesn't talk anything about building secure software. There's a separate thing called ISO Common Criteria, and some high assurance operating systems that are used by the military are forced, you know, required to pass these much more rigorous tests, and nothing of that sort has been applied to these voting systems. Likewise, software that, you know, flies airplanes, software that runs medical equipment, is subject to a huge amount of regulation because you don't want planes falling out of the sky, and you don't want medical gear, you know, mismanaging your vital signs and killing you. So none of that kind of regulation has been, or that kind of independent inspection has been applied to the software that's maintaining our democracy. And just like the software that maintains, you know, you when you're hooked up to, you know, in surgery or what have you, you'd like to believe that the software that makes our democracy go is going to work. And if not, then we have potentially a real problem.
Okay, well, across the United States, I don't know how many states have put in electronic voting systems. I'm sure they're all getting it going to one degree or another. I wonder how many different companies, different kinds of software these different states and different precincts are using in their electronic voting machines. Is it like one company has the contract for everybody, or is there 1,000 different kinds? Or
there are three big firms who have the majority of the market. Those are ES&S, Election Systems, something or other, I think is what it stands for, Sequoia, and Diebold. The one we have here in Harris County in Houston is one of the second-tier vendors, Hart InterCivic. And there is a whole slew of other vendors out there trying to sell gear. But, you know, Diebold, ES&S, and Sequoia have the bulk of the market share.
So what does that mean in terms of the security? I mean, I guess my common sense tells me if there was 1,000 different kinds of software to run 1,000 different kinds of voter machines, that it'd be harder for any organized group to subvert the election. as opposed to
certainly diversity is right. I mean, certainly if everybody, we've seen this with these recent Windows worms and viruses. When all the machines are the same, then a flaw in one is a flaw in all of them, and that can be taken advantage of very quickly. So certainly there is, you know, resilience in diversity. I'll give you that. But, you know, there's certainly a risk. We would like these machines. Okay, so when you build something to be secure, the first thing that you do is you ask yourself, well, who's the adversary and what are their resources? So you think about an election. Think about how much money is at stake in an election and how much effort goes into and how much money gets spent on electing a given candidate, particularly for a national election.
We have to assume, like in a presidential election, that the full resources of the federal government could be intervening. We'd have to assume unlimited resources could be applied to trying to break in to fix
it. I mean, when you're talking about an election system, it's not inconceivable that a foreign government, you know, spies and all that, might have a legitimate reason to want to influence an American election.
Another very good point. Not just the incumbents, but foreign powers too.
Right. So the election system, if you do a serious, you know, sober threat analysis of an election, you realize just the what a daunting task it is. Because on one hand, you need to have an election system that is simple and comprehensible so that way your grandparents can vote and they understand what's happening. And at the same time, it needs to be strong and robust enough to resist agents from a foreign government trying to influence the results. That's a pretty tall order. And traditional voting systems that are based on paper actually have a fairly good resilience, because if your goal is to, you know, influence the entire electorate nationwide, you have to go and influence that paper in every precinct where it's cast. But when you move to a software system, now when there's no paper anywhere, you only have to change the software potentially in one place, and now you can influence the election everywhere.
I'm sorry, so, I know it's not the point you're making, but the all you'd really have to do to influence the election with the paper ballots is make the change down at the central counting place, because they no longer count the ballots at the precincts before they take them to the central location, right?
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. In most other countries, they actually do count the ballots in the very same precinct where they're cast.
I know that's the way it used to be until like the 70s or something, right, here in the United States?
Well, what really changed in this country was the number of things that we had on the ballot got to be, I mean, you know, especially here in Texas, you don't just vote for your presidential candidate. You vote on all these different judicial things. You vote on constitutional amendments. There's, you know, 30, 40, 50 different questions on a ballot. And trying to tally that in every separate location by hand could get painful. And once they move to punch cards, the punch card readers are not something you know that would be expensive to install everywhere. Although there are other systems, the sort of what are called optical scan systems, basically just bubble forms. You know, think about your SAT or GRE. You fill in a bunch of bubbles, and there are variations on that for elections.
Are those any harder to break into, hacking wise, than the new kind of voter computers?
Well, the name of the game here is, sure, somebody could potentially compromise the software, but as long as every voter who voted saw this piece of paper that indicated their intent, you know, this is the so-called voter verifiable ballot.
Right, or last voter time verifiable. I voted, it printed out a little receipt that said I voted, but it didn't.
Yeah,
tell
so
me
not that. So think about back in the old days. I mean, think about the way it works in, say, a country like Mexico, where they give you a card that has, you know, however many names on it, and you put a big X next to the one you want to vote for. In a world like that, as long as that card isn't lost or destroyed, then you count it, and then you can recount it. So if you have a precinct where the, you know, for some reason, let's say that we have Alice and Bob running against each other in an election. And the polls beforehand had Alice leading by like 60 to 40. And then mysteriously Bob came out ahead, you know, 55 to 45. You'd say, boy, that's a pretty radical swing from the polls. And so then you say, maybe we better go recount that precinct. And you can go back and find the original cards and count them again. That's being able to recount as a way of you know, whenever you think something is inaccurate, being able to go back and spend more effort and, you know, fix, potentially discover problems and fix them. That's an important property. I mean, people who run elections, that's what they do. That's an important part of their job, is trying to identify when these kinds of irregularities occur, and to the extent that they can, try to correct for them.
Yeah, and so if it's all computerized and somebody wants a recount, all you can do is turn your head and look at the monitor and say, yep, that's what the number says.
Yep, and they can say, well, you know, you can press the recount button and bink, it comes up with exactly the same answer every time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not very satisfying. Whereas if the recount, so different sorts of counting might have different sorts of accuracy. If you have punch cards, you know, the punch card readers, we know all about the inaccuracies that they have. And if the punch card, but if the punch card reader gets it wrong, then you have a bunch of, you can line up a bunch of people and train them how to look at cards and, you know, define what a hanging chad is. But at least you can have some way of getting a count of the cards that everybody can agree is the correct answer. Even if it's more expensive to do, at least it's possible to do. And if the election is really, really close, then at least it's possible to get as close to an accurate answer as is possible.
Well, what if you could have, say, like, real-time on the Internet updates of what votes are cast for who, so that you could have, you know, millions of people all over the place could all be looking at the votes as they come in and all be watching to make sure that, hey, you know, just now 80 votes all went at the exact same time to this or that guy.
Well, it's technologically feasible to do that, but the politicians would probably tell you that that's a bad idea, because if the vote is swinging heavily one way, then that encourages the other side to do a get-out-the-vote campaign at the last minute. You know, if the East Coast votes are all swinging heavily towards the candidate, maybe West Coast people won't even bother voting. So those are the sorts of arguments against early release of polling data.
Right. Well, I can see, I guess in the presidential election where you got a bunch of time zones messing things up, but otherwise, I see that as probably pretty healthy. You know, hey, the other guy's pulling ahead, man. Everybody call your friend. And you know what I mean? What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on this. All I know is that the people who do elections seem to think that it's a really bad idea for information to get out early. I mean, there's a lot
okay,
of different
well, what
ways
about
you
this? What about, what if it just went from the voting machines to, say, three or four separate databases that, say, nobody's watching them necessarily in real time, but that it's going to so many, the information's going to so many different places at once that you won't be able to go back and change it without getting caught, something like that?
Sure, so what if the machine reports the wrong answer to all four places?
Uh-huh.
So that's where we get into the gist of my work, which is saying, why should you trust that machine that's sitting in front of you? It doesn't matter how many places you record the answer if you record it incorrectly everywhere.
Right. And I guess, you know, the only reason I should trust it is because it's really sleek looking.
And, yeah, it's shiny.
Yeah, and the computer screen has really nice red, white, and blue. And
yeah, it has a little waving flag on it.
Yeah, I guess that was the only reason I can come up with to trust it so far.
Right, and so that's what worries me. I mean, it's just not acceptable to have voting systems where you're asked to trust the pretty little waving flag, and that's going to convince you that the system is safe. If you can't see, you know, just by visual inspection that the system is clearly safe, then you're being asked to have faith in something. You know, you're being asked to have faith that the system was audited carefully. You're being asked to have faith that not only that the software that the auditor looked at was good, but that somebody didn't mess with the software, install a patch or something in between when the auditor last looked at it and when you're putting your vote into the machine at the end. They're just computers. And like any computer, they've got software. And like any software, it can be patched. I mean, hopefully a normal voter walking up to the voting machine doesn't have access to, you know, enough of the guts of the machine to be able to patch it, not without, you know, tearing the machine apart in the voting booth. And that would probably get noticed. But if one of the election workers who had access to the machines beforehand messed with it, who knows? What if, you know, the voting machines were, you know, when I vote in the rec room of a local church around the corner from my house. Those voting machines are probably just locked into the room the night before. Is there an armed guard standing there? I never saw one. So somebody who knows how to pick locks could have uninterrupted access to that room full of voting machines the night before. Who's to say they couldn't install software patches on the voting machines? That's why voting machines are really difficult to trust in general when there's no paper. But let's say there is paper. Let's say you have the same shiny computer in the front, but a computer printer attached to it in the end. So what I'm about to describe the way the voting machines in Brazil work. Brazil's been doing computerized voting for like 10 years. So you punch in the number for your candidate who you want, shows you a picture, etc. When you're done, it prints out a card that's held behind a glass window. So you can see it, but you can't touch it. If you're happy with what it says, you hit the done button and it falls into a little hopper behind the voting machine. If you're unhappy, I'm not entirely clear on what happens, but there's some process for removing that card from the machine. Maybe, you know, you could imagine having a button that you get to press it and you watch the card get shredded into confetti. Exactly how it works isn't all that critical. What matters is, if the voting machine software is wrong or incorrect for any reason, so long as the voter reads that card and the card matches what they thought, then the software doesn't matter anymore. Either it produces the card that says what the voter wanted or it doesn't, period. So suddenly, you know, when you don't care, then now you don't care about the software anymore, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, that sounds like it's got to be the solution, because there's no way that in this culture you're going to get people to just say, you know, we don't need to make voting high-tech. Let's just leave it how it was. Or, you know, people, they want to computerize everything. So it's actually quite pleasant to hear a professor of teaching people computers at a major university saying, you know, paper's what you can trust, you know?
Well, the reason why, I mean, it's not that I have any love of dead trees. The nice thing about paper is once the computer prints it, the computer can't unprint it. It's out of the hands of the software at that point. And before it gets cast, it's visible by the voter. And the only way to accomplish anything like that is to have something, some record that isn't computerized that the voter can see.
Sure. That could make for some really fun times, too, if you think about it. The computer returns come back that night, and one person is declared the winner, and then when they finish counting the paper ballots a week later, they find out that it was 10 points the other way.
Yeah, I mean, and you're absolutely right. Because you've got computers, of course, computers are generally fairly good with numbers, and so you got several entirely different ways that you could count the election. You could have a quick and dirty count, which is just the computer inside itself keeps track. But now you're counting on software, but it gives you a number fast. And you believe that number is approximate. You know, it's rough. So if it says the election is 55-45, you like pack on a plus or minus 5 to that. So it's uncertain, but it's something. Then these cards that are printed out, because they're printed by a computer, not written by a human, a computer is really good at reading something printed by a computer, optical character recognition. And think about, banks have these machines that you drop in a stack of bills, and the machine sucks the bills through really fast and tells you how much money it is. You can have machines like that whose job it is to add up these cards, and they can go really fast and have much better accuracy than a punch card machine could have. because there's no question about hanging chads. It was printed by a computer. As long as the computer didn't run out of ink, and if that happened, then the voter would say, hey, my printer's out of ink, let's try it again.
Right, but then you're still trusting the counting to another computer.
All right, but that's the intermediate step. That's an intermediate count.
There you go.
And also, oh, by the way, if you print these things on standard-sized cards with standardized fonts, then you can now buy voting computers from 20 different companies. You don't care who made the voting computer as long as it can print in the right font on the right size piece of paper. So now you're not locking in your city to a single vendor. That's a good thing in general. Now, you know, that'll drive down the cost of the machines because now they're commodity parts. So, you know, not only is there a security argument, there's also just a good economic argument.
Yeah, competition saves money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who'd have thunk? So, but not only, okay, so now you have a system that is more secure, it's simpler, and it's cheaper, and you've got three different ways of counting up the election. You could count it up purely inside the computer, you could have computers scanning the cards, or you can have human beings reading the cards manually. So you've got three opportunities, potentially. And you may never need to have the human beings counting the cards by hand. But the name of the game in election is not actually naming the winner. You'd think that that's what elections are about, but that's not true. The name of the game of an election is convincing the loser that they lost. It doesn't matter who you say wins. The winner is all will be happy to take it no matter what. You have to convince the loser that, in fact, they really did lose the election. And that's why when an election gets close, the loser says, I don't buy it, I want a recount.
Right, so the best possible world there is all three. So that way the newscasters can come on immediately and do their little immediate thing. And then by the end of the week, we can have had the computer count the paper ballots and have human count the paper ballots and make sure they're all consistent.
Right, and if you do the computer count of the paper ballots the same night as the election, and it says that, you know, Alice beat Bob 60-40, odds are Bob will concede the election at that point. But if you get a situation like Florida 2000 where it's down to a couple hundred votes, then you can, it's perfectly legit to say we really need to have people count these by hand, and you can, and it's technologically feasible to do it. And that's the kind of world that I'm advocating and a lot of other academics out there are advocating.
Are any Texas politicians paying attention to you?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't get into this game until it was much later. By the time that... So I first got into this in summer of 2001. So, you know, a couple months after the whole Florida debacle had sort of, finished itself up. You know, because Harris County had decided that they were going to buy, you know, these computerized systems, and I was asked to testify about it in front of the Houston City Council. But, you know, due to politics that I don't entirely understand, the county went ahead and bought it anyway. You know, by the time that I got involved, it was too late to do anything to stop it. The money had already been spent. And that's another thing worth pointing out. This Help America Vote Act, HAVA, a federal bill, you know, allocated several, I think, $1.5 or $2 billion to give municipalities the funds to purchase new voting machines. And so it's not, you know, just because I say these voting machines are bad, you should buy something else, it's not clear we're even going to have the money to do that because these voting systems were bought with this big chunk of federal cash that might not be there again, even if the ones that we bought turn out to be junk.
Right, even though most of the country didn't really have a problem voting last time. And
yeah,
many precincts in the state of Texas, for example, might not have even wanted or needed an updated voting system.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most insidious form of federal or national government encroachment on constitutional federalism is the grants to states and localities to change their ways.
Well,
when it's,
you know,
our money anyway.
The exact deed, you know, I don't study, you know, state-federal relations. I mean, this is a topic that's been, a topic of wide debate as long as our country has been a country. You know, and so nothing you or I say today is going to affect that debate much.
Rats. I was hoping now the whole world was going to change their mind.
Well, you know, we do the best we can with what we got. And so, you know, right now I'm trying to focus on this one tiny little piece of the puzzle. Right? I mean, sure, there's all kinds of things I would love to change about the way our government works.
Well, I wouldn't say that your piece of the puzzle is so tiny. It seems to me pretty much basically the foundation of everything else. No one could possibly hope to change their congressman they don't like and replace him with a new guy if they can't even trust the darn voting machine at the church down the street.
Yeah, I mean, the freedoms that we take for granted in our country, there are several things that they stand on. One of them is the voting system, like we've talked about. Another one is having a free press, because if you don't believe what you read in the press, how do you know how can you make an informed decision about who you're voting for? Likewise, there's having access to the polls. You know, it doesn't matter if you know who you want to vote for and the voting thing works, but you have to pay a poll tax or what have you. You know, if they park police cars out in front of the voting station, and that might scare off people who are worried they'll get deported from the country. Well, you know, that kind of shady behavior.
Yeah, here in Texas we used to have a great thing called the grandfather clause where, oh, you're black and you want to vote, that's fine, come on in. Oh, wait a minute, could your grandfather vote? Oh, I'm sorry, if your grandfather couldn't vote, then you can't vote. It's not because you're
right.
Black, it's just because your grandfather couldn't vote.
Right, so all of these things, you know, have to be in place. And yet, when you start talking about voting, you start talking about voting rights, and next thing you know, you're talking about, well, what happens if somebody is in a wheelchair? What happens if somebody is blind? What happens if somebody isn't a native English speaker? And, you know, one of the things that the Help America Vote Act was designed to do was to make voting more accessible. And that's a perfectly good thing. And I certainly support having a voting machine that, you know, somebody who's blind can put on the headphones and be able to vote by themselves. I think that's fantastic. But it doesn't matter how much of a warm, fuzzy feeling you give that voter if the machine just turns around and counts their vote some different way anyway. And, you know, this is something that is remarkably difficult to explain and to get across, you know, in like a short soundbite in a newspaper. You know, and here we have the luxury of talking a nice long interview. But trying to explain to people that, you know, gee, it's really nice that you get a chance to vote by yourself, but it's too bad the machine won't count your vote correctly.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know. I can see a pretty sharp headline here. You know, professor of computer science says you can't trust voting machines. That's pretty simple, you know. The guy who understands how all these dumb computers that we all use every day actually work on the inside is telling us that you can't trust a voter computer. That's enough to get my attention, enough to, you know, get me to get you on the show.
And I appreciate that. Another argument that we've heard actually from secretaries of state and from Diebold is, well, sure, you only looked at the voting terminal. You didn't look at the whole election procedure. You didn't look at all the people involved in an election, all the policies and everything that they're supposed to do. And yeah, we didn't, because we didn't have to. You know, we just looked at the computer and we looked at what a voter could do in the voting booth and said, sure enough, voters can do all kinds of bad things in the voting booth.
So even just a voter who doesn't have access to the inside of the machines could still go in there and commit some fraud.
At least for the source code for the Diebold machines that we read, that was absolutely true. I can't speak for Harding or Civic. I can't speak for Sequoia or ES&S. I'd like to, but none of those vendors have given us the opportunity to look at their source code. They just say, trust us. Oh, those problems with Diebold, oh, those don't apply to us. We're much better. Well, why should I believe them? The burden of proof is on them.
Hey, their PR people ought to be advising them that they ought to be rushing to you to vouch for their stuff if it's so good.
It hasn't happened yet.
Well, maybe there's something that they don't want you to find. So, I want to understand how, when you said the Diebold systems that you did look at, that a voter could go in there and, vote multiple times or erase the guy before them's vote?
Okay, so let me see. Let me try to explain this. The way that a Diebold voting machine works, you walk into your polling place, and you wait in line. You prove to them that you're allowed to vote in this particular voting place. Right? In some places, that means you show them a driver's license. Other places, you don't even have to show any ID. Like in some states, you just have to walk in and say, I'm allowed to vote here because I say I am. And then that works. You know, you name it, every place, the rules are different. But once you get past that stage, then you know, like at least here in Texas, you sign your name in a big book. Right? You've seen that in Austin, right?
Sure.
Right, so you sign your name in the big book.
Unfortunately, it's usually a very short list of people who have voted before me when I get there.
Okay. So you sign your name in the big book, and then what will happen if it's Diebold gear is they'll hand you a little plastic smart card. It's the same size and shape as a credit card, but it has some little metal contacts on it. There's actually a computer chip inside there. So you're holding this card. It has a nice picture of an eagle and the flag on it. You know, it looks very patriotic. And you walk, eventually you get up to one of the voting machines. So now, in theory, the voting machine doesn't know who you are. It just knows that you're somebody holding this card. You shove the card into the machine. There's a little slot in the front. And then it says, okay, I see that you haven't voted before. Here you go. Tell me who you want to vote for. Click, click, click. And when you're done, it says, thank you very much. Have a nice day. Meanwhile, it had a little conversation with that smart card and told the smart card to wipe itself out. Okay?
Sure, it told the smart card, hey, you can't be used again.
Sure. And then you drop the smart card in the box on your way out the door, and then they can reprogram the smart card to turn it on for the next voter. That's the general idea.
Okay.
So what we found is you could make your own smart card. Now, it turns out that's real easy to do. All the parts you need cost, a blank smart card is like $2 or $3. A smart card programmer, the piece of hardware you plug into your computer is at most $100. And, one person can buy one of these things and crank out a whole bunch of cards. And then that part where the card has a little conversation with the voting terminal, since you program the card, you can make it do whatever you want. When the voting terminal asks the card, hey, are you okay? Are you allowed to vote? The card can say, yep, yes, I am. And because they didn't do anything fancier than that, the voting terminal just said, oh, okay, and happily let you go ahead and vote. So you could build, so you could design and build your own little card. You swap them. Instead of putting the official card in, you put your card in. And you vote as many times as you can until somebody gets suspicious. You know, how long can you stand in place before somebody looks over your shoulder and says, hey, buddy, how long are you going to be there? You tell me, 10 minutes, 20 minutes?
Hey, I'm having a hard time understanding the wording of some of these constitutional amendments. I want to make sure I don't vote right.
Yeah, I'm reading them carefully here.
Yeah. So,
but you don't want to be there.
How many precincts or states or whatever across this country have these Diebold systems?
I think Diebold has somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of the market. I don't know exact numbers.
I just cannot believe that this isn't the top story all over every bit of media.